This and the expunging of troubling adjectives is a level of censorship I can accept. To leave them in order to maintain a sense of period or cleave to the author's vision risks too much harm, especially in view of this author's vision being more akin to dictation, for too little good. What you find at best among supporters of leaving things unaltered is a presupposition that all children have on hand a watchful adult who can inoculate them against any unbeneficial effects via lively, contextualizing lit-crit debate whenever a dirty caravanner pops up. And this, of course, is not so. In more recent years, the debate has been over how much to update the rest of Blyton's language. A few years ago, the famous five were brought out in new editions to be sold alongside the previous ones that had their vocabularies subtly updated by the publisher so they did not alienate readers, as in the publisher's view they were now at risk of doing so. Mother and father became mum and dad, school tunic became school uniform, she must be jolly lonely all by herself was changed to she must get lonely all by herself, and so on. The cost-benefit analysis of this works out very differently from that of excising racist terms and attitudes. The benefit amounts to a short-term gain in immediate comprehensibility, but amongst the costs, we can count the fact that a constant updating of books decreases the opportunities for making those little intellectual leaps that make reading both fun and valuable. If straw boaters had been replaced by hats or excised entirely in Dorita Fairleigh Bruce's Dimsey adventures, I probably still wouldn't know what they were. A few years later, I would feel the rush of triumph when I worked out what school colours were in Antonia Forrest's Autumn Term, although it took me most of the book and the end-of-term prize-giving scene to be sure that they were indeed a kind of sporting award. Children can and should be left with these little leaps to make. No harm will come to them. If a child reader cannot discern the meaning of school tunic from its context, said child reader shouldn't be left unsupervised on the sofa with the book anyway, lest they accidentally suffocate themselves in the cushions or blind themselves with their own thumbs. In addition, such changes collapse time and remove all sense of history. Placement in time is important. As a child, you naturally believe that the world around you is immutable. A gradual realization that people once spoke, dressed, and even thought differently from the way we do is a profound pleasure. Queer once primarily meant odd. How weird. A tunic and a boater comprised a uniform. And one day, of course, our children will be asking, "What's a uniform?" and we will have to revise again. The honour of the school was once a real and motivating force. I remember asking a teacher about the last one. She gazed at me with such sadness that I wished I had one of those handkerchief things I'd also read about. It struck me that they would have been as good for mopping tears as they were for binding gorse-wrenched ankles during clifftop rescues. Without a sense of time, the integrity of the book begins to break down. More changes will soon be needed to make sense of mums and dads who let their children roam free on Kirin Island, of girls who get lonely because they are forced to stay behind and make bracken beds and tea for the boys. Root out jolly, and you have to root out all these oddities, and the gorse bushes too. How likely is it, after all, that our increasingly urbanised young population has ever seen one of them? And then you'll be left with an awfully queer set of books indeed. It was with a great sense of satisfaction, therefore, that I greeted the recent announcement that the updated books are to be discontinued. Parents, who still buy the bulk of books for children of Blyton reading age, were apparently staying away in droves. I suspect this was for nostalgic reasons rather than philosophical principle, but hey, whatever works, right? Perhaps years and years and years from now, Blyton's 1950s idioms will be truly impenetrable, and change will be genuinely necessary if she is to continue to be fit for her particular purpose, which is to serve perfectly the purely narrative appetite of a child that precedes more sophisticated tastes, and which must be simulated and satisfied if those tastes are ever to develop. If the gap between her written and their modern language becomes wide enough to deny children this inestimable good and this incalculable pleasure, then by all means let us throw our handkerchiefs, uniforms, mothers and fathers to the wind. But we're not there yet. All that said, when I look ahead to my son's Enid Blyton years, I am divided. On the one hand, I long simply for him to be reading independently, and not just because it will leave me with much more time to read myself, although this is a large part of it, and also a large part of what makes me a terrible mother, and to find as much happiness there as I did. On the other, if he finds his reading feat amongst more modern fare, less riven with outmoded attitudes and almost certainly better written, as virtually all contemporary writing for children is, the market and level of competition having changed beyond all recognition since Blyton's day, there would be relief in that. His Blyton years may not come, of course. Some children pick her up, do not like her, and put her down again. These are generally clever, sensitive children who are more or less born ready for literature and for whom an absence of psychological realism and complexity is both baffling, frustrating rather than soothing or relaxing. I think my son, who is currently trying to burst a balloon with his teeth, will have his Enid Blyton years. Imagine having a child who had never raced around Kirin Island with the Five or crammed into the meeting shed with the Secret Seven or teased the village policeman with Fatty. What's a village policeman, Mummy? And couldn't even Enid have come up with a less profoundly literal, deadeningly prosaic title for a series than The Five Find Outers and Dog? Or swum in the rock pools of Mallory Towers with Daryl and the gang? Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh he might be, but could we ever be really close without that? My parents did their duty unquestioningly and unhesitatingly, simply shoveling the necessary volumes at their grateful, albeit wordlessly, sorry about that, offspring for the next two or so years that the enchantment held, and trusting that something would eventually come along to break the spell. I can hardly do less for my own. I won't even have to spend the money that they did. All my paperbacks are here waiting for him. They are mostly horrible night editions, not like Becky's, with stills from various television series on the covers, instead of proper illustrations, a practice I abhorred then and abhor now because there are some prejudices we should never give up. The remainder have awful 1980s drawings of schoolgirls in modern uniforms and clutching modern pencil cases, but they are mine. I may now read them and weep with boredom, but it was not ever thus. Every volume is a slice of my heart. How can my son, who is all the other bits of my heart, not take them down from the shelf and complete the circle? What else do we have kids, or keep our horrible night editions, for? I wish I could say that a particular book came along and broke the spell. It would be much more dramatically pleasing if I suddenly happened across a set of Dickens or something, calfskin bound in a dusty attic I was exploring one Sunday at a friend's house, why not? Or on the bookstall at the school fate, whose fragile ancient pages revealed to me a whole new world, a transformative understanding of what life and literature could be. But I didn't. Wrong kind of friends? None. Wrong kind of houses, modern, non-rambling, and wrong kind of school. Instead, I came out of my Blyton phase slowly, as one emerges from a fog, until I stood blinking dazedly in the sunlight, ready for something new. My eight-year-old mind wanted something more. It didn't know precisely what, but something. While I'd been away, several new additions had been made to my bookcase by my dad and occasional visiting relatives. They had been bought as tokens of faith in a non-blighted reading future, looking for a long time like hostages to fortune. But now they took on the sheen of sound investment as I turned my avid, covetous gaze upon them. What was there? A golden age. Chapter 5. Through a Wardrobe. The first book I picked out of the waiting row was Pale Pink and earned my respect immediately because, like Millie Molly Mandy's adventures, it had been both written and illustrated by one person. In this case, a former art student called Eve Garnett. She had been commissioned in 1927 to illustrate a book called The London Child by the suffragette and social reformer Evelyn Sharp about working-class conditions in the capital. The book I was holding in my hands 50 years on had grown out of the research Garnett did for that commission. It was called The Family from One End Street and told the story of the Ruggles family, two parents, dad a dustman, mum a laundry woman, and seven children, Lily Rose, Kate, Jim, John, Joe, Peggy and William, who lived at number one, One End Street, in a small town called Otwell-on-the-Owes. I was captivated by it from the start, including and especially the drawings, as sweet, strong and deceptively simple as the book itself, because I knew, as I had known with Millie Molly Mandy, that they depicted the real thing, straight from their creator's pen. I was, I see now, bound to end up the person I have indeed become, one who screams herself hoarse before the television screen and seeks to bring down the blackest curses upon any casting director who has deviated from the on-page description of anyone in a book's adaptation. Unlike Blyton, The Family from One End Street was episodically structured, each chapter a little self-contained adventure had by one of the children, and all the characters were rendered equally lively and interesting, but all utterly different from each other, and all utterly real. It was the first book I had loved for a long time for its characters rather than its plot. It was also the first book, not only for me but for all its readers when it was first published in 1937, to make urban working-class children its heroes. It was almost universally lauded for this upon publication. Some critics later came to discern a patronising tone from Garnett towards her characters, but others praised her for avoiding both sentimentality and condescension and replacing them with what one called a careful truthfulness instead. Not that I knew or cared about any of this at the time, of course. I just knew it was a strange relief to spend time with book children who, like me, whatever the technical differences in our respective classes were, had more experience of a world bounded by building sites, patches of grubby parkland, and knackered working parents than they did of one strewn with rolling moors, private islands, and spies. The family from One End Street won the Carnegie Medal in 1937-1938. It beat, and this gladdens my heart more than it should for reasons we'll come to soon, The Hobbit. Eve Garnett should, as far as I was concerned, have had at least another two medals under her belt, because even better than her first book, I soon discovered, was the sequel, Further Adventures of the Family from One End Street, in which Peg, Joe and Kate go to recuperate from measles in the countryside, the place I longed to be and which I was still unaware lay barely a dozen miles south of Catford. The rest of the family remain in Otwell, having almost equal fun raising a pig on the allotment. Even better than that was its sequel, where Kate gets to return sans siblings to the picture-perfect village of Upper Cassington and stay for the whole summer with the Wild Gooses, owners of the local hostelry, in Holiday at the Dewdrop Inn. This seamless progression gave me a wholly misguided sense of life as a process of cumulative improvement, which it would take several painful years of experience to dispel, but on the plus side, Holiday at the Dewdrop Inn trod the pleasures of reading even deeper into my soul than Enid had. It was as if, with the story of Kate Ruggles's summer-long stay and enthusiastic embrace of village life in Upper Cassington, Eve Garnett had peered into my mind and written down exactly what she knew would delight me most. It was Millie Molly Mandy writ longer and with a character I could feel in my very bones. Kate, you see, was bookish. She was the reader in the family and had her heart set on a scholarship to the local grammar school. And she longed to live in the country, not the town. I didn't know exactly what a scholarship or a grammar school was, but I knew that they were things from the past, and that I too would have wanted both if I had not had the towering misfortune to have been born in the now. She was me and I was her, and when, in the midst of my devotion, the Mangan family rented a cottage in Cornwall for our fortnight summer holiday for the first time instead of staying with Grandma in her Preston flat, it was as if the already porous boundary between books and reality had finally done the decent thing and collapsed completely. I looked up from Kate's collection of wildflowers and water lilies for the village fete and saw them as well. She wandered in awe along overgrown lanes, and I totally would have too if I hadn't been so busy reading. But I could see them. My sister went down them and reported back. Yeah, plants, fields both sides, brown things in one of them. I want to say horses? By the end of the holiday, I knew what Kate meant by cow parsley, stiles and haystacks. I'd seen a thatched roof. It was more than enough. I identified less thoroughly with the heroine of the next book Dad brought home, but I loved her nevertheless. It was a book by Mary Norton, who once described herself as a fits and starts writer. I love just living, unless some wonderful idea suddenly appears. Here, in my hand, 30 years after it was first published in 1952, was her most wonderful idea. The Borrowers, the story of Arietti and her parents Homily and Pod Clock, who belong to the race of tiny people who live secretly in the houses of human beings, under the floorboards, in the clock's case, above the overmantel, or behind the pictures on the wall. They use drawing pins as candle holders, stamps as pictures on their own walls, small coins as plates and cotton reels as stools. Oh, the joy the skewed perspective conveyed by these repurposed objects gave me. And that is why you can never lay hands on any of these vital items, no matter how many you know you bought. Shut up underground with only a grating to give a glimpse of garden and sky, Arietti, for years I thought it was a misheard borrowing of Harriet, but a musical friend of mine thinks it's meant to recall Arietta, a little aria, longs to be taught to borrow and to be allowed outside, despite her people's fear of being seen by their giant unwitting hosts. This is why our protagonist-slash-reader identification broke down. I could think of nothing worse. Being outside, being actively engaged in honest and or physical toil does not a happy bookworm make. To this day I cannot relax unless I'm wholly enclosed by four sturdy walls and a proper roof, where the wind will stop messing with my clothes and blowing my hair across my face so I can't see the page, and the sun will not cause me to be distracted from full reading immersion by worrying about skin cancer. My husband puts the fact that I won't even have a window open, even at the height of summer, down to my Irish peasant ancestry. It's always raining in your DNA, he explains, which may also be true. But Arietti is made of braver and livelier stuff, and eventually convinces her parents to relent on the borrowing front. She is soon spotted by the lonely boy who has come to stay in the house. They become friends, but when the rest of the household discovers his secret, the borrowers are no longer safe and the little family must flee. The perfectly realised miniature world is naturally people's strongest memory of the book. Norton was very short-sighted her whole life, and the borrower's environment, whether under the floorboards, out and about in the house's drawing room and nursery, or in the fields and furrows across which they travel in the sequels, always has an absolute authenticity about it. The textural truth of someone who has spent her life with her nose squashed up close to things. Where others saw the far hills, the distant woods, the soaring pheasant, she once wrote in an essay, I, as a child, would turn sideways to the close bank, the tree roots, and the tangled grasses. Moss, fern stalks, sorrel stems created the mise-en-scene for a jungle drama. One invented the characters, small, fearful people picking their way through miniature undergrowth. One saw the smooth places where they might sit and rest, branched stems which might invite them to climb, sandy holes in which they might creep for shelter. And of course that kind of detail with which the borrowers is strewn is both memorable and delightful. But I suspect that it is often cited simply because it is also the easiest element to put into words. Because if you first read it as a child, you cannot put a name to the uneasy feeling within you that the book evokes, and so perhaps as the years pass, the memory falls away. I'd forgotten it myself until I reread the book a few years ago. Beneath the melody of Arietti's story, the fun and adventures swinging across curtains with your hatpin, meeting the boy and evading capture by exterminators, there is a haunting strain of melancholy compounded of her hunger for freedom, the fragility of their essentially parasitical lives. Part of Arietti's journey to maturity involves her facing up to what the boy sees as a self-evident truth, that the borrowers are dying out. And the ceaseless circumscription of their activities by the need for secrecy and the concentration of generations of fear under the floorboards. Looking back, I can see that this dark undertow, tugging me in a different direction from where I thought the book should be taking me, was a milestone in what I suppose we should call, though it feels unsuitably clinical, my reading development. Even if I didn't understand fully at the time what was going on, it prepared me at some level for the fact that good fiction, future fiction, might not just be about the story, but that it could and would give a voice and shape to larger, wider truths. That it could, in short, be greater than the sum of its tiny, perfectly proportioned parts. Now that was, indeed, a wonderful idea. The Borrowers was my first foray into fantasy. Technically, and appropriately enough for a beginner who was also temperamentally very much inclined against abrupt change and preferred gradual introductions to new things if new things had to be introduced at all, it was what is called low fantasy. In other words, very little magic is used, and sometimes, as in The Borrowers, none at all. A thing that could not actually occur in reality, like little people living under the floorboards, is simply presupposed to exist, and normal life goes on around it. High fantasy is stuff set in alternative, secondary worlds, which will have their own internal rules and logic, but differ vastly from the real, primary world. Lord of the Rings is generally held up here as the ne plus ultra, and possibly the sine qua non of the genre, and we'll come back to that, even though I get tired just thinking about Tolkien. Thus I was primed by the little people to take the next step, a little further up, a little further in, to Narnia. I went through the back of a wardrobe, of course. Narnia. Here, said Dad awkwardly, when he handed me a paperback showing a lion and two girls capering on the greensward with a garland of flowers. I think you'll like this. I knew just what this kind of impassioned speech signalled. This was not just a book my dad thought I would enjoy. It was a book he had enjoyed as a child. I said thank you and added a nod to show that I had understood. He nodded equally eloquently back. My watching mother rolled her eyes and poured a gin. The book was called The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. The lion all began with a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood, its author C.S. Lewis once wrote. This picture had been in my mind since I was about 16. Then one day, when I was about 40, I said to myself, let's try to make a story about it. The heroine was called Lucy. Not enough books, to my mind, had heroines called Lucy. Since reading Catherine Storr's Lucy and Lucy Runs Away, I had not really seen that there was any argument for calling any heroine anything else. Now, at last, here was another one, and I couldn't have asked anything more of her. She was brave, yet sensible, pushing through those fur coats, yet being careful not to close the wardrobe door behind her in case she got trapped. And I knew I shared at least one of those characteristics with her. She was a beleaguered underdog, who isn't, who nevertheless endures and emerges triumphant, just as I planned to do one day when I was really old, probably about 20. Her siblings, Peter, Susan and Edmund, all eventually follow her through the wardrobe and into the snowy lands of Narnia, where it is always winter and never Christmas, thanks to the evil spell cast over all by the White Witch. But Edmund has been enchanted by her too. Thanks to his greedy acceptance of her proffered Turkish delight, Never take sweets from strangers and or majestic allegorical satanic figures on a sled, kids, and harbours treacherous intent in his bosom. On her first visit, Lucy meets a talking lion called Aslan, who fills her heart with love, and she promises that she will return to help him. But her brothers and sister do not believe her, though Edmund is lying. Oh, Edmund, the hate I felt for you then may never fully leave me. And she almost has to go on without them. At the last minute, Aslan becomes visible to them. He exists! In your faces, arrogant older siblings! And the stage is set fair for an epic battle between good and evil, sacrifice and selfishness, courage and cowardice, played out amongst an array of characters, including Mr. Tumnus the Fawn, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, a wish-granting white stag and other talking beasts, unicorns, dryads, dwarves, naiads and centaurs, as the children and Aslan fight to end the reign of the White Witch and restore Narnia to its people, who will then be ruled over by the four children, who will sit as kings and queens at the castle of Caer Paravel. But a benevolent monarchy still beats a monstrous dictatorship, so all is well. Their adventures play out against backdrops drawn from the medieval poetry, fairy tale, folktale, Celtic, Norse and classical myths, legend and scholarship that Lewis loved and had immersed himself in all his life. Interwoven with these, and providing the overall spine for all seven of the Chronicles, is a version of the Christian story, and this aspect has caused some controversy over the years, best summarised by an exchange I had a few years ago with the friend of a friend. I was flicking through the bumper Christmas Radio Times at a party, like the vibrant social butterfly I am, when the hostess looked over my shoulder and told me, I don't know why, I hadn't asked her, but that's people for you, always yapping, that she would let her children watch the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe film that was being advertised as that year's big festive centrepiece, but would never buy them the books because of the Christianity in them. She also objected to their snobbery and misogyny. I should have left a set of Enid Blyton behind and listened to the screams all the way home, but apparently trusted the celluloid version to have been run through more modern moral filters and be less injurious to infant psychic health. I'll be honest with you. I do have one friend who got about halfway through her first perusal at the age of 9 or 10 of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, turned to her mother and said, "This is about Jesus, isn't it?" But she was the offspring of two vicars, long story, and I suspect that at the time was probably seeing Jesus in her cornflakes. Me? I was about 14 and ploughing through the very last pages of the final volume in the Narnia series, The Last Battle, when the Pevenses returned to stay forever in the magical land after they're killed in a train crash. It was only then, after the biblio equivalent of being hit over the head with a claw hammer, that I began to feel the semblance of a shadow of an inkling that something funny was going on. Lewis was an atheist who became a devout and publicly proselytizing Christian. By the time The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was published, he was already famous for his faith and for his accessible prose and radio broadcasts about aspects of his belief, which gave succour and strength to a nation during and after the Second World War. Even as a child, there had been times when a profound sense of the ineffable had moved through him. In his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, he tells the story of how, as a boy, his older brother, Warnie, once constructed a miniature twig and moss forest for him on a biscuit tin lid. And the young Jack, as Clive Staples Lewis was always known by friends and family, was overcome by a mixture of longing and elation, an unsatisfied desire that is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. This was before his mother died in 1907 when Jack was 9. "With my mother's death," he says, "all settled happiness disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, many stabs of joy, but no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." Almost immediately afterwards, he was sent by his loving but grieving and misguided father to a boarding school in England that was run along strange and, even for a child who hadn't just been bereaved and in effect abandoned, unsettling lines by a headmaster who was later declared insane. Jack retreated into the Norse myths and legends whose pure northernness, bleak, wild, cruelly magnificent, was both purgative and balm for a boy in mourning. Out of that came a career at Oxford and then Cambridge as an English and medieval scholar. He was involved for 30 years from the age of 20 with a woman called Mrs. Moore, the mother of his friend Paddy. The young men had met during officer training and had promised to take care of the other's single remaining parent should one of them die in the war that they were about to go off and fight. Paddy was killed in action in 1918. Lewis lived with and loved Mrs. Moore, certainly as a second mother, probably as a lover, until she died in 1948. Maybe without that great motherless void to fill, he would have been satisfied with myths, legends, an ordinary wife, and an ordinary academic life, giving us another scholarly tome or two to add to the Bodleian shelves. As it was, he found God, Mrs. Moore, and writing for children, and gave us Narnia instead. At the time, however, I did not know all this heartbreaking stuff, and I was simply furious at the deception, sneaking this god stuff in without telling me. Turns out Aslan, with his rightful kingness and his infinite wisdom and forgiveness shtick, and willingness to sacrifice himself for sinful Edmund, was Jesus. The Pevenses are his disciples, Edmund a bit of a Judas, and the White Witch the devil. Narnia's heaven. Get out of it. But eventually my rage subsided. It was still a very, very good story, after all, as were all the others. The magician's nephew, the one with the magic rings and the hero Diggory's dying mother, miraculously restored to health, as building your own fantasy world allows, by Narnian fruit, was written after The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but forms a prequel to it. Prince Caspian's The Lion sequel, written by Lewis while The Lion was still going through the process of acceptance and publication in 1949-50, and according to a letter from Lewis to an American reader, is about the restoration of the true religion after a corruption. For oblivious me, it was simply an even more potent rendering of, and deeper immersion in, the Narnian landscape. The Pevenses return to the magical kingdom to find that hundreds of years have passed, civil war is dividing the kingdom, and the old Narnians, many dwarves, centaurs, talking animals, the dryads and hamadryads that once animated the trees and other creatures, are in hiding. The children must lead the rebels against their Telmarine conquerors. The warp and weft of Narnian life is seen up close in even more gorgeously imagined detail than the previous books. Lucy, awake one night in the thick forest that has grown up since she was last in Narnia, feels that the trees are almost awake, and that if she just knows the right thing to say, they would come to Narnian life once more. It mirrored exactly how I felt about reading, and about reading Lewis in particular. I was so close. If I could just read the words on the page one more time, bring one more ounce of love to the story they told, I could animate them too. The flimsy barriers of time, space, and immateriality would finally fall, and Narnia would spring up all around me, and I would be there at last. Alas, it never quite happened. Nevertheless, despite this betrayal, Prince Caspian remains my favourite of the Narnia stories. Although if you ever confront me, I will deny it to the ends of the earth because my first loyalty must always be to my dad and the piece of his heart he handed to me with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third to be published in 1952, finishes Prince Caspian's story with his quest to find the seven lords who were banished from Narnia when Miraz took the throne. It's too good. In fact, on the days when Prince Caspian isn't my favourite, this is. Unless it's The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which, let's face it, it always is. Even when it's Prince Caspian. Yes. The Silver Chair is great but has none of the Pevensey Quartet in it, so must regretfully be relegated to the second tier of favourites, wherein also languish The Horse and His Boy, fifth to be published in 1954, but third in reading, which is to say Narnian chronological order, because it has no children or animals from the real world at all and goes far too nearly the full Tolkien for my comfort. And then, of course, The Last Battle. For anyone worried, like mine hostess, about their children being secretly indoctrinated into Christianity, let me just say this. No child ever has, or will be, converted to Christianity through reading about Caer Paravel, Aslan, Naiads, Dryads, Hamadryads, Fauns, and all the rest. If they notice it at all, they're far more likely to be narked than anything else. And they probably won't notice it at all. They are relatively literal creatures. At most, they will spend a few days tapping the backs of wardrobes, hopefully. Yes, I did. Well, only the old wooden one in the spare room. All the others in the house were white melamine-covered chipboard, which was inimical to mood. But they are unlikely to go up to the nearest cleric and say, I'm looking for a saviour analogous to a fierce and benevolent lion who died on a stone table to free his people from tyranny. Do you have anyone who might do? The Tale of Lucy Pevensey Discovering the Secret World Beyond the Wardrobe Door is a story about courage, loyalty, generosity, sacrifice and nobility versus greed, conceit, arrogance and betrayal. You can call the former Christian virtues, or you can just call them virtues. Let the kids concentrate on the self-renewing Turkish delight, magically unerring bows and hybrid man-beasts, and relax. I should have told my interlocutor over the Radio Times that she could probably relax about the snobbery too. Just because Lewis refers to whatever grapes your people may have doesn't mean the modern child feels crushed beneath the weight of interwar class distinctions. They haven't even noticed. There's a bacchanalian rite going on at the time for a start. Sanitized for juvenile consumption, but still, trees are dancing. As for misogyny, this charge always seems to be based on a disdainful reference in The Last Battle to elder sister Susan succumbing to the lure of face powder and stockings. But her brother adds regretfully, she always was in too much of a rush to grow up. This is not an objection to femininity. It's the author sorrowing over the passing of innocence, making the point that to wish childhood away is, Christian or not, a terrible sin. Oh, and the film's a perfectly acceptable denatured, deracinated pabulum, filtered through Disney's bean counters instead of the roving imagination of one of the greatest masters of English fantasy fiction. I should have broken every DVD I could find in that willfully impoverished house. English children's literature is considered a treasure trove of high fantasy, but Narnia was as far as I wanted to go. I liked, still like, my flights of fancy firmly rooted in reality. I needed to be able to get back through the wardrobe or out from under the floorboards. The borrowers were welcome to share my world, but I did not want to be a visitor stranded in someone else's universe entirely. Which means, of course, that I've never got to grips with Tolkien. I just can't. Mere thought of that maniacally detailed world exhausts me. I got through The Hobbit, or Bilbo Bloody Baggins as I still quietly refer to it, despite the world filling over the last 10 Peter Jackson-infused years with die-hard fans of the whole thing, under duress at secondary school. But A, it never took, and B, The Hobbit is to the rest of the saga as a jog round the block is to back-to-back Tough Mudders. If the first nearly kills you, you don't go looking for more pain. And I feel very bad about this, not just because I have body-swerved a major literary landmark, but also because I feel obscurely that I have let C.S. Lewis down. He and Tolkien were, with Charles Williams, the Inklings, a part club, part literary society that met in Lewis's or Tolkien's college rooms at Oxford, or less formally at the Eagle and Child pub nearby, to read and discuss their latest not-yet-published writings. The likes of G.K. Chesterton, George MacDonald and Roger Lancelin Green used to swing by too. So did Dorothy L. Sayers, though she was never allowed at the college gatherings because she was a girl. Top tip. If reincarnation is a thing, you really should try and get reborn as a white male Christian in the vicinity of 1950s Oxford. Nothing will go far wrong for you after that. It's possible that I am actually Inkling opposed and that C.S. Lewis is in fact an exception to my unsuspected rule. I've still not read Chesterton or Sayers, and George MacDonald is a victim of my animus towards all fairy tales, bar the ones on the Ladybird Library carousel of yore. And Roger Lancelin Green was the author of the first book I was ever defeated by, despite actually wanting to read it. My rule about fairy tales, before we go on, is that I don't read fairy tales. But that is completely, and I mean completely, stupid, I hear you cry. Are you a full idiot or what? To which I can only say, I know, I'm sorry, and yes, probably. I've tried to break my self-imposed embargo many times over my reading career with various Andrew Lang collections and Grimm's Treasuries and Hans Christian Andersen compilations, but it has never worked. Beyond Ladybird age, everything that had recommended them suddenly became infuriating. I was never again seized by the elemental simplicities, the eternal truths enshrined by enduring symbols and archetypes. I just got frustrated by the lack of detail, the implausibility, the unrealism. Instead of evoking a sense of wonder and limitless possibility, they just left me wanting more. Maybe I never had the imagination that should rush in to fill the gaps. Maybe I started my degeneration into the awful, literal, unromantic, cynical, canker-hearted beast I had become earlier than I ever suspected. I feel similarly about short stories now. If you've got a good idea and a plot, give me more. Give me all of it. I am aware that this is to miss the point of short stories entirely. Being a bookworm does not necessarily mean being a good reader. But back to Roger Lancelin Green. A Tale of the Tale of Troy. I recently came across the fact, or possibly factoid, but it rings true to me, so I'm going to consider it so until persuaded otherwise, that we learn the vast majority of our vocabularies by the age of 18. After that, you doubtless will accumulate a few more dribs and drabs, but they'll never become part of your working semantic database, or, for the more romantically inclined, your soul. You will not have easy mastery of them, never deploy them as often, willingly, or confidently, as you do the ones you imbibed before your post-pubescent brain started to calcify. What is true for words is, I think, maybe even truer for stories. I opened up Dad's latest offering, Roger Lancelin Green's The Tale of Troy, and couldn't make head or tail of it. So many polysyllabic people. Philoctetes and Neoptolemus? Are you sure? Places, battles to keep track of, and the bit about the hollow horse took an age to turn up. None of it would go in. I felt, reading it at the age of 8, the way I feel when I read about economics now. I simply don't have enough background knowledge. Special purpose entities, synthetic collateralized debt obligations, are you sure? Enough pegs driven sufficiently securely into my mental wall to hang the new information on. I can follow it, just about, as I'm reading, but the minute I finish a chapter or turn a page, the whole lot just slips to the floor in an untidy heap. Maybe if I had got on with the tale of Troy, or if, as less mud-turtly children might have done, sought out something that could bridge the gap between those two volumes of Ladybird's famous legends and Llansellyn Green's retellings, it would have been my gateway to yet another world. I would have been plugged into that hidden realm of classical influence and knowledge that still infuses, though most of us barely realise it anymore, everything around us. I might have become aware of a heritage that was, at least as far as state-educated 1980s South East London world was concerned, only being handed down in random fragments now. I finally read The Tale of Troy, along with all Roger Llansellyn Green's other retellings, versions of Arthurian, Norse and ancient Egyptian stories alongside the various books of classical myths and legends, about 10 years ago, and they were as powerful and thrilling as anything I've ever read, a cluster of potent, intoxicating tales which escaped my prejudice against fairy tales, which I had half expected to envelop them, by being so devoid of whimsy, so detailed and so altogether authoritative and convincing. His King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table was the springboard from which I dived back into the pool of medieval literature I had only dipped a fearful toe into at university. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Sir Orfeo, Chaucer and, of course, Malory himself. It was a wonderful few months. But it was also too late. Not for pleasure, as I say, it was wonderful. And not for gleaning a few reference points with which to orientate myself slightly better as I plough on through my library and, secondarily, life. But it was too late to make the books and the legends part of me. They are not, and never will be. I had hoped I'd feel like Susan Coolidge's character Katie Carr arriving in Europe. She had browsed all through her childhood in a good old-fashioned library, writes Coolidge, and had her memory stuffed with all manner of little scraps of information and literary allusions, which now came into use. It was like owning the disjointed bits of a puzzle, and suddenly discovering that, properly put together, they make a pattern. But in fact, what I have is just a few more bits of the puzzle. What you've never had, you'll never miss, they say, and of course we all know this is nonsense. I feel the loss of missing out on the illuminating power of Roger Llansellyn Green's books quite specifically and acutely. Every volume is a more hardcore version of what Lewis did in each Narnia chronicle, an effective condensation of a country's folklore and archetypes that are also, centuries of cultural cross-currents being what they are, our own. They should be part of everyone, and that means bringing them together at as early an age as possible, so that they are a pattern ingrained rather than a puzzle forever. Fashions in education and in reading change, but King Arthur, the Tale of Troy, the Saga of Asgard, and all the rest are eternal. That is what legend provides, the sense of a connection reaching back through time, deep into the ancestral wildwoods, where an unacknowledged part of each of us still lives. Something visceral, elemental, and, given the right teller at the right age, something understood. No wonder Lewis loved them so. I wish I'd been able to make the leap between him and the rest in time. But I didn't. I turned, without demur, from the age of heroes to the age of heroines. I discovered Noel Stretfield. Stretfield. All children are, at a certain age, consumed by a ravening lust for stardom. In my playground, girls tended to express it through the reenactments of great moments in social history. Bucks Fizz's skirt ripping, Lady Diana's wedding, Jane's transformation in Neighbours. While the boys went more for sporting glory. In the football games that went on every playtime, they were all Kevin Keegan on the inside. Noel Stretfield had been sating this egomaniacal hunger, in girls mostly, since 1936, when she wrote her first book for children, Ballet Shoes. The story poured off my pen, more or less telling itself. I distrusted what came easily, and so despised the book. Her readers had no such compunction. Ballet Shoes was an instant hit, and is probably still her most famous and popular novel today. It is the story of three orphan children, Pauline, Petrova and Posy Fossil, who claw their way up from nothing but a comfortable upper-middle-class post-war background to train at Madame Fidolia's Children's Academy of Dance and Stage Training and become the most renowned dancer, theatre actor and, engineer of their generation. But the Fossils weren't who I first met. My heart belongs instead to Sorrel, Mark and Holly Forbes, the protagonists of Curtain Up. This is the story of three orphan children who claw their way up from nothing but a comfortable upper-middle-class post-war background to train, thanks to scholarships from the Fossil Sisters, at Madame Fidolia's Children's Academy of Dance and Stage Training and become the most renowned dancer, theatre actor and, impressionist of their generation. I'm teasing, of course, a little. because although Stretfield's books do tend to adhere to the rags-to-riches formula, they also depart from traditional wish-fulfillment stories in important ways. For a start, all her characters are realistic children, like those of her idol, E. Nesbitt. Stretfield's heroines, and occasionally heroes, are all fresh, natural, lively personalities. In Curtain Up, Sorrel is the responsible, anxious, oldest child. Mark, a bit of a sulker, always in need of cajoling and managing by those around him. While the baby of the family, Holly, has a sunny self-belief and the kind of imagination that easily leads her to become convinced that she did not steal a coveted attaché case from her cousin Miriam, but that Miriam gladly lent it to her instead. Stretfield's children are beset by the same worries, frequently half-understood percolations down from the mysterious adult world above, or the insecurities that come with needing to make your way in a new school and negotiate relationships with people not immediately willing to offer friendship, as their readers are in real life. And they are capable of great loyalties and tendernesses, yet still prone to the same heart-squeezing jealousies. We have all been Holly at one time or another, even if our heart's desire was rarely a pre-war quality briefcase, though I'd love one now. And petty squabbles as their readers. Stretfield is always particularly good on the agonies of not having the right clothes to wear. Not to stand out, but to fit in. A legacy of her upbringing as one of three daughters of a high-minded, impoverished vicar, and a mother who came down hard on anything she interpreted as a sign of vanity. In Curtain Up, Sorrel longs for a party dress that rustles and sticks out. Suppose it could be yellow, crepe de chine or silk net over taffeta. And in the book I loved almost as much, White Boots, which is basically Curtain Up on ice, Lala has an array of beautiful skating outfits, while Harriet must wear her mother's old pink coat, a humiliation made worse by the fact that she has violently clashing ginger hair. I warmed deeply to this aspect of Stretfield's work. My father wasn't a vicar, but my mother cleaved immovably to the belief that wanting to be anything more than decently covered by burlap sacking was a sign of moral depravity, and shopped for our wardrobes accordingly. I was 25 before I owned an outfit that I liked. I didn't wear it. I'd never go that far. The other major departure from tradition is that once the improbable circumstances have combined to get you to the dancing, singing, acting, sporting, skating, engineering, impressionism, institution of your choice, dreaminess is replaced by discipline and sharpish. Once you're there, you have to knuckle down. It is the willingness to work, to be disciplined and practice, practice, practice until you have mastered whatever techniques are necessary that turns Stretfield's heroines and occasional heroes from merely talented individuals into stars. This is the lesson Stretfield learned during her own 10 years treading the boards, during which she enjoyed all the seediness, glamour and hard graft that came with being a member of the Charles Doran and Arthur Bouchier companies. She bought as many lovely clothes as she could, too. Stretfield's insistence on a causal link between hard graft and success is actually quite a shock to the unwary reader, or at least it was by the time I was reading the books in the 1980s. I had been primed by at least 2 stories a week in the Mandy comics, which Lauren Jones, lovely, kind, generous Lauren Jones, to whom I owe a debt of happiness I can never repay, passed on to me once she had finished with them. To believe that all you had to do was dance well at your local disco or do funny voices for your friends at school, to be plucked from obscurity by a passing agent and hurled into the big time. Now, of course, the two concepts have been uncoupled for so long that Stretfield's books may be starting to read like medieval runes. Kardashian Shoes would be a book with a very different message. But I suspect that if today's star and stage-struck youngsters give them a chance, they will come to life once more. Torridon Library was also providing a plethora of practical, hard-working, morally and economically sound heroines. I had discovered Pony Books, my first taste of the delights of genre fiction, at least if you discount Enid, who was a genre unto herself. I had recently left the wooden bins and small shelves of slim paperbacks behind, and after a few weeks of research in the older children's section, had mustered the courage to choose my first proper book there and seat myself at the big boys and girls table. It was a chunky hardback with line drawings only, I checked, so everyone could be very clear that it had not come from the infant section, and it was called Jackie Gets a Pony. It was by Judith M. Beresford, and in it, Jackie gets a pony. I was thrilled for her, and for me, because it was clear from the proliferation of similar hardbacks on the shelves that there were many more pony-based adventures to be had by her and many other remarkably and delightfully similar heroines. I'm not quite sure why all the greats who had invented and fueled the genre during its 1940s and 50s heyday were still, in the early to mid-80s, so well represented on the shelves. Possibly the librarians were reliving their youths, Or maybe there was some belief amongst authority in proffering characters who lived for tack and mucking out instead of television and boys as a hedge against contemporary frivolity. I can't believe genuine readerly demand abounded. Certainly Jackie and the Pony Thieves, Pony Thieves Steal Jackie's Pony, was always waiting for me when I had read my way through her other 15 adventures and returned, eager to begin the cycle of Branmash-based adventures again. It may simply have been the case that so many pony books had been accumulated during the feverish peak decades that to have swept them all away once appetite had diminished would have left the place too bare. Pony book authors had many things in common. They were often from the same family for a start. Christina, Diana and Josephine Pulling Thompson were sisters, and their mother was Joanne Cannon, one of the pioneers of the genre with A Pony for Jean in 1936, in which Jean gets a pony. But their foremost shared characteristic was their fertility. They were, in the main, writing about what they loved. Horses, ponies, occasional dogs, horses, ponies, ponies. And genre fiction does not require intriguing new plots to be laboured over or emotional conflicts to be wrenched from your soul and rendered in exquisite prose. You can just get on with the job. All were capable of turning out a highly readable book a year. Beresford wrote at least 40 others in addition to her Jackie series over her 37-year career, and the Pulling Thompson sisters were virtually unstoppable. Christine probably takes the crown, though she would probably have preferred a properly soaped saddle, with at least 101 volumes published between 1948 and 1999. I read all that were there. A Pony for Jean and its sequel, Another Pony for Jean. I discover only now, alas, that there was a further instalment called, you'll never guess, More Ponies for Jean. Truly the 1950s were a reassuring time. The Jackies, numberless Pulling Thompsons, and I managed to buy a few Ruby Fergusons. Pony books were nowhere near as prevalent in bookshops as they were in the library. For myself, Jill's Gymkhana and Jill Has Two Ponies. It's possible Ferguson's Jill series stayed in print longer than some of the others, because Jill has a much more modern sensibility than most of the others. Even though some, like the Jackies, were in fact written later. Chapter 1 of Jill's Gymkhana, first in the series of 9 written between 1949 and 1962, bit of a laggard, our Ruby, evidently, titled My Dream, opens like this. Just look at that title. You see, I am the Jill concerned, and quite honestly, if anyone had told me 3 years ago that anything so terrific as the Gymkhana would ever be associated with my name, I should have thought them completely mad. Yet such was to be my destiny. That lovely phrase is not my own. I got it out of a library novel that Mummy is reading. Who could fail to be warmed, charmed, and in immediate need of the remaining octet of adventures? A bit later on, her status as a child for all post-war ages is confirmed by her thoughts on the books her mother has been penning, a la the railway children's mother, had I known it then, to keep penury at bay since Jill's father caught a fever on business in West Africa and never came back to us. It seems awful to say it, but I never could get on with Mummy's books at all. They're all terribly up in the air and symbolic, about very whimsy children who are lured away by the elves of discontent to the Forest of Tears, from whence they are rescued by Fairy Hopeful and so on. I suppose some children must like these books and buy them, or Mummy wouldn't get the checks she does. Or perhaps it is their aunts buy them and give them to the children for birthday presents. Anyway, so as not to hurt Mummy's feelings, I always read every word of her books as they come out, and try to say something appreciative, but honestly, they leave me cold. I would rather have Out with Romany, or The Phoenix and the Carpet, or even something highbrow like The Horse in Sickness and in Health. I can hear touches of Oswald Bastable, Cassandra Mortmain, and assorted fossils in there now, but at the time I loved Jill for herself alone. The library's stable of pony books provided all the pleasures of Enid Blyton, formulaic comfort, certainty, ease, a lot of reward for your reading buck, with a new equine twist and a much more satisfying amount of detail. The authors knew that they were writing primarily for outsiders. Children who actually have ponies tend to be out and about on them, living the pony-having lifestyle instead of just reading about it. And so were careful to explain not just about the strange world of tack, the points system at Gymkhana's, the finer points of dressage and so on, but also to provide plausible enough explanations of how the money was earned and saved, first to buy the pony, then to furnish the kit, provide the stabling, and of course the all-important feed. Oh, the horror of the unexpected vet's bill that could throw off months of careful calculation and wipe out weeks of earnings yet to come from mucking out the stables of richer school friends and pile on yet more pressure to win a cheque at the next county show. But the young reader lives for that kind of granular stuff. Careful, detailed world-building, tells you that the author takes you seriously, that they want you to be right there inside their vision with them. It's an implicit acknowledgement that you might have gaps in your knowledge and an absolute absence of contempt for that. This is a great gift and relief to any child. I also adored the fact that, unlike Blyton's children, Ponybook's protagonists lived in the countryside full-time, not just during the holidays. Don't think I'd realised it was possible before then. I didn't hanker after a pony of my own, specifically, but the lifestyle generally. I still yearned to be surrounded by fields instead of houses and lanes instead of roads full of traffic. No bookworm wants to live in London. It's noisy and hectic, and it just doesn't make sense. Past and the countryside. That's where our souls reside. What we really want is to retire to a tiny cottage somewhere unreachable to all but a chosen few, as soon as we've accumulated enough books and money to be able to live out the rest of our days reading uninterruptedly from dawn till dusk and living on fried potatoes, eggs, and the occasional rosy apple that had been due to be given to a lame pony down the lane. I'll give bran mash a try too, maybe. I think it sounds delicious, and I've always chosen not to find out precisely what it is. If I hadn't given in to marriage and motherhood, I reckon I'd be about 5 years away from my goal by now. Ah, well, at least I've got the books, and I may win the lottery yet. If I couldn't live in the countryside or the past, there was another option to which I was almost equally drawn. Underground. Torridon Library's shelving system was not infallible, and so within the Judith M. Beresford section often appeared books by Elizabeth Beresford. These were about a set of short, stout, furry creatures who lived in a burrow beneath Wimbledon Common, the Wombles. The gentle but lively adventures of the irrepressible Bungo, greedy Orinoco, scholarly Willington, and lovely, loyal, athletic but dim Tomsk, overseen by great-uncle Bulgaria, Tobermory, Madame Cholet and Miss Adelaide, as they go about their business of picking up the litter human beings leave behind to recycle and adapt for their own use, were born of the first stirrings of the Green Movement in the late 1960s and a chance mispronunciation by one of Beresford's children as they walked across Wombledon Common. The Wombles actually moved to Hyde Park in later years, a crazy but true fact which I include here in the hopes that it will propel you to victory in more than one pub quiz over the coming years. They had been embedded in the national consciousness since about 1973, when the stop-motion animation series, voiced by Bernard Cribbins, had begun its 2-year run. The programmes had been repeated many times since, but I wasn't aware of this. My mother had full powers of veto over our television watching, and, for reasons now lost in the mists of time, but which something tells me will have been the mad fruits of dictatorial whim, the Wombles didn't make the cut. I knew them only on the page, save the occasional glimpse on other children's tellies or in battered annuals skim-read at jumble sales. The rough textured nature of the animation and the backgrounds, sets, they must be sets, and the Heath Robinson-esque quality of all the things they built was a perfect rendering of the world Beresford had created, and I thoroughly approved. Most importantly, the series creators had managed to capture the warm safety and cosiness of the Womble Burrow. I remember one day on holiday at Grandma's in Preston, walking over a cobbled stretch of street near the old marketplace, and pointing to them, saying, "This is what I like, this is where I want to be." Because I couldn't convey my liking for the past, I didn't know the word history or historical, which might have gone some way to explaining myself to her. As it was, she thought I wanted to live on cobbles, and watched me closely for years afterwards for further signs of mental instability. I had the same problem explaining my Womble and Burrow love until last year, when I finally came across the word hygge. It's a Danish word for a very Danish concept that has no direct translation into English, but seems to be a mixture of cosiness, security, comfort, kinship and familiarity, coupled with the desire to keep things simple, uncomplicated and unexaggerated. They live it. Bookworms find it down fictional burrows. But whatever works, you know? The Wombles' indefatigable industriousness was also deeply satisfying. The furry clan had the same pleasing purposefulness as all those ponybook children. And all children long for a purpose. And the Wombles' dedication to recycling, to squeezing every last droplet of usage out of everything, seemed an immensely sensible way of life too. Newspapers, old envelopes and bus tickets being turned into papier-mâché and used to make bowls and mend burrow cracks. Jumpers and scarves being patched or unravelled and reused. Tin cans, jam jars and every other sort of detritus being pressed into service of some kind. This all feeds some deep need in the juvenile psyche. I wonder, often actually, about when we lose that aversion to waste. When does that receptive little corner of our mind start to harden and grow impermeable to such simple common sense, and make us into the adults Great-Uncle Bulgaria will never understand, not even if I live to be 300. Are we born pre-programmed with the sound survival instinct that tells us to be careful and salt away our resources against times of scarcity, which the shrieking messages of consumer capitalism eventually drown out? Or is it just another manifestation of the general process of calcification we know as growing up? It's a bugger either way. And now we live in a world where, as I embark on a nightly reading of Bungo et al.'s Adventures to Alexander, Great-Uncle Bulgaria's kindly explanations of the beastly pollution and how to fight it, and Wellington's experiments in the greenhouse resulting in an organic mixture that destroys plastic, read like relics of a ridiculously optimistic bygone age. So not only have we ruined the world, we have ruined the Wombles. The burrow is my refuge no more. Brilliant. Chapter 6. Grandmothers and Little Women. Both my grandmothers were great-grandmothers. Not great-grandmothers, at least not yet. They would become so before they died, but not by my womb. But great-grandmothers. My dad's mother, known as Nanny, had been a nurse in between having 800 children. But by the time I knew her, she was Les Dawson. Chain-smoking, bosom-hitching, permanently smiling through a happy fug of smoke and booze, all snug in their crimpline and gin, I would hear the late, great Victoria Wood sing years later and be instantly catapulted back to Nanny's precarious, there's no friction with crimpline, but coveted lap. Her conversation was a thing of wonder. Up and down and round it went, taking in everyone she'd ever seen, met, chatted to in the bus queue, given birth to, loved, lost, never cared about to begin with. It ducked down side alleys about the shopping habits, scandals, actual rumoured and invented on the spot. Pets, grandchildren, salaries, actual rumoured and invented on the spot. Miscarriages and every other non-salient detail about everyone within a 5-mile radius of her front door. By the end of the afternoon, you were more closely informed about the lives of 1,000 people you'd never met than you were about your nearest relatives. It was impossible to tell how much was true and how much was the product of a lifelong conception of silence as a mortal foe. Alan Bennett once described his mother sitting in the lobby of a hotel they were staying in and speculating on the lives of the other guests she saw passing by. He must be her son, she might say, before embarking on a series of speculations about his likely personal flaws and failures in life. The next day they saw them again and she would say, there goes that son again up to no good, completely unaware of, or at least unconcerned by, the fact that it had all been invented from scratch the day before. That was Nanny. She was great. It was like having a television on all the time, but one that loved you and stroked your face and gave you biscuits whenever you liked. But it did explain much about my father's Trappist approach to life. We value most what we have never had. In his case, it was a moment's peace. When I got a little bit older, Nanny would curl my hair with her hot wand. I think she used it herself to warm up her nighttime whiskey. Gin's a daytime drink, in case you were wondering. And gave me her old powder compacts and various little pots into which she had scraped the ends of her lipsticks. They were all a weird shade of deep pink that somehow managed to be so fantastically unfeminine that it was basically a contemptuous V-sign to all social convention. It was worn only by ladies of a certain heft and vintage, and I have never seen it on anyone or anything since. She also gave me Sam Sylvan's Sacrifice, the story of two fatherless boys, a leather and gilt-bound Victorian treasure. It was a reward book, one of the hundreds upon hundreds of morally sound 19th-century tales, published first by the Religious Tract Society to give to deserving Sunday school pupils, or distributed amongst poor households by parish workers in the hope of making them deserving, but which gradually came to be distributed more widely and published by more commercial, less devotedly Christian outfits. Books aimed specifically at children, as an idea, as a genre, as a product, began in the mid-18th century with an entrepreneurial publisher called John Newbery. The medal given every year by the Association for Library Service to Children for the most distinguished contribution to American children's books is named after him in recognition of his achievement in making children's literature a respectable and profitable field of endeavour. Before Newbery, there had been a few stray bits and pieces for the kids, such as John Bunyan's A Book for Boys and Girls in 1686, which was about as much fun as its 1724 retitling, Divine Emblems or Temporal Things Spiritualized, suggests. James Janeway's A Token for Children, being an exact account of the conversion, holy and exemplary lives and joyful deaths of several young children, again not heavy on the laughs, in 1671, and Isaac Watts's Divine and Moral Songs for Children in 1715. alongside religious tracts that saw pious orphans being rewarded with new, godly families, naughty protagonists dispatched to eternal hellfire, or tiny, shriven souls being vouchsafed redemptive ecstasies on their little deathbeds. But their main aim was pedagogic and salvatory. In the main, children made do with the lighter end of adult fare, much of which still survives in more or less attenuated forms, as children's literature today. Arthurian tales, for instance, the legend of Robin Hood, Aesop's fables, Robinson Crusoe, Gulliver's Travels,